Hey, this is Ed the Sock, and you're listening to The Medley with Blake Crash Priddle. Is that what you wanted me to say?
That's good, Ed. Thank you.
All right.
Everyone, welcome to The Medley. I'm your host, Blake Crash Priddle, and it's good to be back after a short break. I hope that you enjoyed your summer, and this time we're going to be speaking with Stephen Kersner. Stephen Kersner is a media personality and the creator and performer of Ed the Sock, the famous Canadian sock puppet that used to be a VJ on Much Music. Stephen is going to tell us the story of how he got into the media industry and how he created Ed the Sock. Bring us back to your very first media job.
My first media job was playing a battered egg in a, I think it was a Hanukkah special with my Hebrew school on cable access television. That's not really where it began. I wanted to make movies originally. And well, my dream was to make a movie about Bigfoot because I was so inspired by the $6 Million Man episode with the Sasquatch. So I took my bar mitzvah money and I bought a Super 8 sound film camera. The problem is that film back then, very expensive. It was expensive to buy the 3.5 minute cartridge and then expensive to process it. I did a couple of films for school. But then discovered that there was this Cable 10 station, this cable access Cable 10 station that was not part of the Rogers empire. It was this little independent that was next door to Rogers. And it was, you know, 10 minutes from me. It just happened to be in a different cable district. And there was something magical about the fact that it was so handmade. Like everything just seemed so handmade and there was no pretension because they couldn't afford it. And so I thought, you know what? Those are the people I want to do TV with. And also, I have a better chance of getting there. So me and a couple of friends put on our suits that we wore at bar mitzvahs. And I brought a valise that my dad had. And we went in to meet with the program director and assistant program director and sketched out this show we wanted to do, this comedy show. And they said, yeah, okay, go ahead. And that's sort of where it began. We did a bunch of comedy shows, and I discovered there was a real void in this TV station because nobody really gave a crap. And so I started volunteering and eventually volunteering 4 nights a week and putting extra effort into these shows. And people noticed, the producers noticed. At first, I was given all the trouble, like the people who were a pain in the ass. And then I just kept expanding. Every time I saw there was an opening or a vacancy of work that could be done, I did it. I even made myself my own office in the tape library in the back. And it just slowly came to be someone they relied on because otherwise the stuff would slide back into lousy production values. And I then was put on part-time staff for 38 hours a week, because if it was 40, I'd be full-time. And I was doing this after high school, like after school ended, because the station didn't open till 3 p.m. and went to 11, because people doing the shows, producing, hosting, were all volunteers. So they'd come in after work. So anyway, I did that, had a lot of fun with it. And I was the assistant program director. And the program director himself was quite an interesting character. It was my first exposure to malignant narcissism perhaps sex addiction. I don't know. But he cared less and less about the station, and he would wait until the people who owned the station, like the owners of the company, the cable company, would go home at like 5 o'clock, and then he'd leave and leave me in charge. I was like all of 15 at this point. He got a job at another TV station and convinced the management that he should still be in charge of this TV station because I was nowhere near ready. But the owners got a little wise to the fact that he never showed up. He never came in. He would call and say, are there any calls? And then that would be it. So they pulled me aside and said that they knew he wasn't fulfilling his end of the contract. And being a loyal idiot, I said, oh, no, he comes in. You just don't see him. And they said, no, don't cover for him. We know. It doesn't matter what you say. We know he's not here. So we want to fire him and give you the job. And they said, we're firing him regardless. So what was I going to say? I took the job. They said, we think you can do a good job. So I took the job. I was 18. immediately just recognized there was so much potential at this station because it was so community and so connected and so absurd. Like we had no money for anything. When the owners would get new furniture, we would either get the old furniture, which was too heavy to use, because it was old European-style furniture, or we would get the cardboard boxes from the new furniture, which we would use to make desks for panel shows and throw a cloth over it. But there was just so much freedom, and I just burst with ideas. I only gave shows to people, well, not only, but primarily gave shows to people who were quirky, and the kind of people that would normally never get a television show. One guy was the buggy guy at the local supermarket, but he wanted to do a show, so we gave him a show, and it was hilarious. He became a local hero, and I gave lots of different charity groups, but also people who just were totally overlooked and would never get a show somewhere else because their talents were not mainstream. What else? I was elected chairman of the Metro Cable Association that first year, which was a collection of all the cable associations in Toronto, which at the time I thought, wow, that's an honor. And then I realized nobody else wants it. And they rapidly started hating me because these guys were managers who worked 9 to 5. I didn't come in till 3 o'clock. So I hated going to their meetings in the morning and wanted to go back home and nap. So they loved spending time at the meeting because they weren't at the office. So they would just go over the same topic over and over and over again. When I was chair, I said, there's no further ideas coming forward. We should vote on this. Oh, no, we should talk about it further. I said, no, we're not talking about it further unless anybody has anything new. And nobody had anything new. And so these guys went back to their respective stations instead of just telling their boss that, it ended when it regularly did and taking an early lunch or a longer lunch. And that's sort of where that brings you up to the point when Ed happened.
Yeah, I did a little bit of research before the interview started that you created Ed the Sock from some materials that you found in a drawer.
It was actually a filing cabinet, but yes, it was. I had a friend who, I still have the friend, who was doing a talk show, a sort of humorous, quirky, odd talk show, because he was humorous and quirky. But he needed somebody who understood the rhythms of television better, when to go to a break, when an interview had exhausted itself, because we didn't have commercials. I started instituting commercial breaks using public service announcement videos, because audiences were conditioned for commercials. So he needed somebody who would be a co-host to guide him. Now, at the time, I was doing serious political programming, and I wasn't going to be a second banana on a comedy show when I was doing serious political programming. So, and also the co-host had to be someone who's at the station all the time, because his taping times were completely erratic. So he and I had been making fun of a friend's, a couple of adults that we knew, and we'd been doing their voices and characters. So I went to the filing cabinet where the kids' show Arts and Crafts was kept in their little puppet sets, and I took there was a set that was supposed to be a park, which the grass was green fun fur. I cut some of that. There was, for some reason, one sock in there. It was unused, but there was one sock in there. Took the top of Yoo-Hoo glue sticks and made eyes with little Letraset letters that became sort of the pupils. And I had, for some reason, a Colt Mild, the baby cigarette, or baby cigars people used to have with the wine tips. And so I just put this together and merged the two characters that my friend and I had been doing. And that's where Ed came from.
So Ed the Stock started off on a community cable station, but then he appeared on Much Music and City TV. How did you and Ed the Stock end up on those two stations?
I was having fun with Ed's show while still doing political stuff. I was a candidate in the 1990 provincial election, God help me. I was, 23. But Ed kept getting more and more popular. It was a hobby for me. It was fun. And everybody at the station had fun doing it. So it became a talk show. The original guy left. He was in university. And we had a couple of other people. We eventually got this guy named Stan Glass, who was just your quintessential schmo. Balding with a comb over, high whiny voice, stilted delivery. He actually had come in to be a guest on a singles show. And I remembered him from when me and my friends were younger teenagers. He used to run the local school, public school, elementary school, had a tennis court, believe it or not. And he used to run the tennis club there in the summer. And we used to stand, whenever he played, we used to stand outside the fence and go, "Stan, Stan, 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 Stan." And it just completely threw everybody off and nobody wanted to play with him. So I remembered him as this schmo. And he just wound up being the perfect foil for Ed, because Ed would insult him and nobody felt bad for him. There's just certain people that nobody feels bad for them when they're being insulted. So the show, you know, picked up steam and people were doing what was viral in those days, which is recording it on VHS and sharing it with friends. And then Stan got a job that made him unavailable and lucked into a great comic named Eric Tunney. May he rest in peace. One of, if not the best stand-up comic I ever saw perform. He really turned stand-up into an art form. And he had slick back hair and his Buddy Holly glasses, always dressed immaculately in a suit. So he was the perfect counterpoint to Ed's rough demeanor. And that made the show get really, really big. They changed the name of the show from The Late Late Show, before there was ever an American by that name, and made it Ed's Night Party. I don't know, that name just came to me in the shower one day. And the show got bigger and people were passing around tapes and we were getting attention. News, like big broadcasters were doing stories about us. So the show got more popular and Ralph Ben-Murgie, who was a Canadian broadcaster, was doing a CBC late night show at the time. It was big, ballyhooed, expensive show. CBC was, "We're doing late night, five nights a week." And they poured tons of money into it. And even after they tried to renovate it, it still tanked. And people were saying that Ed's Night Party, with a budget of 25 cents, is a better show than the $1 million an episode spent on the CBC late night show. So that comparison helped propel us a little further into the public eye. And then it's interesting because I sent a copy of it to Moses Neimer at City TV. And he sent back my original letter and he scrawled in the corner, "Sorry, not our format." Okay. And then the CRTC put out a call for a number of licenses. One of them was for a comedy channel. And Chum, City TV, wanted to get a comedy channel, but they couldn't apply unless they actually had a comedy show on their station. And here was Ed's Night Party, already a successful comedy show. They wouldn't have to do any development. They wouldn't have to do hit and miss. So they came to me and proposed that, and they wanted Ed to be on Much Music at the same time. And initially I resisted. I was like, "Oh, I don't want to be on Much Music." CBC also came and made an offer, but I knew CBC, first of all, they would tell us we can't do any of the comedy we were doing before. We'd have to clean it up and be completely different and not be rough around the edges with the seams showing. And then we would lose the audience and we'd be gone in six episodes. So I went with Chum. At that time, though, Eric Tunney, because he'd gotten successful as a result of Ed's Night Party, decided he didn't want to go to City TV with the show. He wanted his own show. Without a co-host. And there were people telling, like the Broadway Video does Kids in the Hall, it did it at the time, he was friends with those guys. They were saying that they can get him a show. So he left And we had to get, he left just as we were, we announced we're going to City TV. I found out in a quote from him in the newspaper. So we had to scramble and get another co-host. And Humble Howard, who was a very popular radio DJ, morning guy on 102.1 The Edge, then a popular radio station. And I had met him and we worked, you know, he came and became the co-host. And then the show just evolved from there. My first three seasons, I had a partner who is now a huge production company, but our visions didn't mesh. So he stepped away and we ended our partnership. And that's when I started completely remaking the show. And we can talk about that later if you want. But that's where the evolution really started, is like season three. And that's when my wife, Leanna, wasn't my wife at the time, when she came on board the show, she also added another perspective that helped the show grow. So it didn't stagnate and just become this novelty that wore out. And I started on Much Music at the same time. The first show on Much Music was a show called Smash or Trash, which was Moses' idea based on an old radio show. Is it a hit or is it a miss? And the idea was, we had this panel of like people from the musical world and Steve Anthony and Ed. And we would play a music video and then give like a Ebert and Siskel review. Each person would give a review of this video. It was horrible. It was ponderous. It was dull. And it was a dumb idea to begin with. And so we ended that. They tried a couple of other co-hosts with me, but it was like the format sucked. And then Ed just sort of became a VJ and took over, you know, got more and more popular. I have to say that Denise Donlin, who was running Much Music at the time, a woman of great vision, did not like Ed and didn't see where he fit. But Dave Kynes, who was second in command, he saw where Ed could fit. And I think he saw things beyond even what I saw as possible. And so I have to give him credit for standing by me when a lot of people like get that off the air. And Denise for trusting in Dave. She said she used to chew pencils when I was on the air live, because it was live, like no delay. It just sort of built from there, and Ed just became a personality and became bigger. And then Ed's humor was much more rough around the edges back then. It was different times, different kinds of humor. And I was also younger. I was in my 20s. So, you know, the kind of humor that appealed to 20-year-old boys appealed to me.
Well, because I'm pretty young, I didn't really get a chance to watch Ed the Sock on Much Music, but I have watched quite a few YouTube videos of him, and I watched a couple of older clips from Much Music on YouTube of Ed, you know, criticizing and praising some music videos, and Ed always makes me laugh.
Wow, that's thank you for sharing that. Well, you don't, when you're doing television especially, you know, now I'm doing radio and it's direct response because I do a live show. I want live calls and I get them. But when you're doing television, even when it's live television for Much Music, yeah, we had people outside the window and, you know, that were excited and so on. But you don't know how far it goes beyond that. You don't know if this tomfoolery that we're doing is anything more than tomfoolery. Does it have any value whatsoever? I remember after 9/11, there was a lot of talk. Entertainment Weekly had a cover that said, is this the end of comedy? Like as if nobody would ever laugh again. And you don't realize that these laughs are reaching people in ways that you don't predict. And so whenever I hear something like what you said, it's I really appreciate it. I'm glad to know that the work I've done and that I'm doing has a good impact on people. That's very important to me.
I especially liked it when Ed the Sock tried to interview those anti-lockdown protesters in Toronto. That always puts a smile on my face, especially back then during the pandemic, because I thought, my God, you know, just covering the news and everything, you know, it's just so depressing. And then having to listen to stories about COVID deniers and then knowing that Ed is doing the right thing. I mean, that just made things a lot easier for me and for a lot of other people, too.
Great. Thank you for that as well. There's a second part to that that for some reason never got posted. I did two parts that day with different people. And yeah, it's interesting you say that Ed's on the right side, because people have this perception of Ed as anti-establishment, anti-authority, which Ed is. But the underlying there has always been anti-stupidity, exposing blatant stupidity. And yeah, back when it was focused on pop stars and the music industry, not hard, you know. But I used to do editorials every Monday on my Ed's Big Wham Bam show, and they were always about serious topics. They were about 3 minutes long, and they were always about serious topics. And they made an impact with people in government, people in organizations. But people don't remember that. And so nowadays, when anti-establishment takes the form of blatant lying and bullying and ignorance and bigotry, when that's seen as the anti-establishment, and Ed is against all of that because the root of all that is stupidity, ignorance and stupidity, and people embracing their ignorance and stupidity. So that's the opposite. I mean, that's what Ed's always fought against. But these people think that because Ed's method of delivery is loud and, as I say, rough around the edges and in plain language, you know, with the same volume, perhaps, as these right-wing people who are yelling, they assume that Ed's got to be right-wing, too. And Ed was always right-wing, and Ed never was. I'm proud that, with Ed, we talked about gay adoption and gay marriage and said, people, you know, why isn't it there? We did comedy bits about it, but the point was, it was absurd that it wasn't legal. We were doing that before there was any conversation about that. Ed was always part of the Much Music Pride Parade. There's just, Ed's always been progressive. Now, when the people who speak of Ed's volume in media are all shouting ignorance, and Ed's speaking at the same volume and seems to have the same kind of swagger, but is speaking, not speaking the dog whistles and the code words of the right, but is in fact speaking much more from a centrist, small L liberal position. There's people like, you sold out, you're a cuck, you're Ed the cuck, you sold out. And it's like, no, you just remember wrong.
I would say that a lot of my political views are very similar to that of yours and Ed the Suck. And sometimes when I talk to my friends about my personal political views, I'll tell them that I'm an Ed the Suck liberal, kind of like a South Park Republican. Yeah, you may have heard the term South Park Republican, and I say I'm an Ed the Suck liberal. That's because I'm very socially progressive, but I'm not the kind of person that takes things too seriously. Sometimes in life, you just have to learn to take a joke and stop and think before you freak out over something posted online.
That's fun. Do they know what you're talking about when you say an Ed the Suck liberal?
Oh, yeah, I have.
Ed has a platform and a voice. I don't. Like me as Steven, I'm just another guy out there. But Ed, because he's earned people's trust and affection over the years, and people have a nostalgic emotional connection to Ed, and they believe the character says what he believes, but isn't a radical. People call the radio show. They say, "Oh, it's an honor to talk to you." And I'm like, "Give me a break. I'm just another guy doing a job like all of you people overnight." I even talk, like, when you meet celebrities, they treat Ed like he's the celebrity, not them. And by the way, they treat Ed that way. When I bring Ed out, Ed receives a very different reception than I do. Christina Aguilera, I used to interview people before they were famous, because some of the other VJs were like, I don't want to talk to them. Nobody knows who they are. So I always took the ones that nobody wanted, because I felt, give them some publicity. Not all of them went anywhere, but Christina was. I remember the first time I interviewed her, she just walked across the street from the record company building to Much Music, out in the public, nothing. Nobody knew who she was. And she always treated Ed like somebody different than me. So when I go to do interviews with her, because after the first interview, she wanted more interviews. In fact, she would only do interviews on Much Music if she also got an interview with Ed. When I would go to, she was very cordial to me. You know, Steven, she was very cordial to me. But when I would put Ed on and lift Ed up, she'd, "Oh, Ed!" It was like we were two different people. And that's happened so many times. One of my favorite anecdotes that I feel proud of is when I first did the interview with Christina, it was the day before the Much Music Video Awards. And they'd been trying to get her to stay for the Much Music Video Awards, and she kept saying no. And I did the interview with Ed, with her, with Ed. I'm driving home on the Don Valley Parkway after that, and my phone rings, and it's Dave Kynes, operations, head of operations there at Much Music. He says, "What did you say to Christina Aguilera?" And I'm thinking, oh, shit, what did I say? What, is there some problem? And I said, "I don't remember. We talked about her album and stuff like that." No, what did you say to her? I said, "I don't, you've got the tape. Go look at the tape. I don't know." I said, "Why?" And I said, "Why? Are they complaining?" And he said, "No, she's saying now she will stay for the MMVAs, but only if Ed interviews her again." And that was a great, celebrities initially did not want to be interviewed by Ed, because, and I can understand it. Wait, I'm being interviewed by a sock puppet? I'm a serious artist. But once people got the understanding of what Ed was about, and that the interviews weren't stupid, like they weren't sock puppet stupid interviews. Yeah, there was ribbing and, you know, light insults. It was the kind of stuff your friends would say to you at a bar. Once they recognized that it wasn't the same bloody interview they'd done all day long on junkets, they all wanted to do the interview.
Well, Ed the Sock is certainly a very versatile character, can do shows about music and then, of course, political commentary. You know, he does a lot. And one of my favorite Ed the Sock videos on YouTube was when he added some color commentary to an interview with Allison Court, also known as Lunette the Clown. Do you remember that one?
No, I know Allison. I don't remember that at all.
I just happened to come across it on YouTube, and Ed made some off-color jokes about the big comfy couch that everyone seemed to like.
Jeez, I have no memory of that at all. Yeah, I mean, this isn't unusual. Because remember, I like Fromage was a really popular show. That was where Leanna and I would, primarily Leanna, would go through the cheesiest videos of the year. And the show had existed before us, but what they used to do was Christopher Ward, the pioneering VJ of Much Music, I will say, and a great recording artist, he hosted it, but as a character named Simon, Simon de Camembert, or something like that, with a bad French accent and a beret and a little mustache drawn on. And his presentation was cheesier than the videos. And the videos they showed were just either really, really low budget, or they were videos from another country. And so it was all, ha ha, look, they have no money. Ha ha, look at those funny foreign people. And when Christopher left, the show officially had been canceled. And but I had hosted it for the two previous years while he was, while Christopher was still somewhat involved with Much. But I didn't choose the content. And I barely chose, like, it was hard to get the voiceovers that I wanted. It was someone else producing it. But when Christopher left, Leanna and I said, you know what? It was 1999. There's a great opportunity to do the worst videos of the century. Going into 2000? Yeah, it was going into 2000. So it was 99 was the one we did going into 2000. Sorry, I sound like an old man now. And we just went through all these songs. We watched hours of these videos. Because remember, these are videos going back to the early 80s, and we're trying to find the most cheesy. It was hard to find ones that weren't cheesy. So we did this show. We chose the videos. We wrote the script, recorded it, edited it, and then just handed it in. Nobody knew we were doing this. And Denise said, "What's this?" And I said, "It's Fromage." She said, "I thought that was canceled." I said, "Well, I guess not." And to her credit, she put it on the air. And we chose, instead of taking shots at foreign videos and people who didn't have any money, we took shots at the big celebrities, the big stars whose videos were stupid or bad messaging or had obvious mistakes. So we took shots at the big guys, the people who Much Music had been celebrating all year long, you know, running their videos over and over and pumping them up. We took shots at them instead. And the change in format resonated with people. And to the point that bands would say, "Are you going to fromage me this year? Can you fromage me?" They weren't insulted. There was a couple of record company people who didn't quite get it, but the artists, they always got it. They understood that it was in good fun. To be honest with you, I was a little more mean than I'd be comfortable with doing now. But you know, you grow older, you have different perspectives.
Another Ed the Stock video that I really enjoyed was when Ed the Stock gave his two cents about a controversial tweet that Steve Martin made about Carrie Fisher. You might remember this one, and that's when you were talking about...
this was from the Hard Rock Cafe show.
That's right, yes. You were talking about how millennials seem to be offended by a lot of things, even little things like that. And I remember watching that thinking, I may be a millennial, but I'm certainly not like these millennials that get offended by little things like that.
Yeah, I remember. That's one of the few things I remember, because that show was such a friggin' whirlwind. Multi-camera show, live, before the technology really existed to do that well. So it was nuts. If Leanna hadn't been there to run that show, it would never have happened. I remember saying that the rant was basically telling millennials they don't own the internet, that they don't get to decide what comments are acceptable or not acceptable. I think that was the nature of the comment.
In the early 1990s, you ran for the Ontario Legislature for the Progressive Conservative Party. Is it true that your political views have changed quite a bit since then?
Oh, yeah. I was raised in a mostly conservative, traditional type home in North York. And as a result, I thought I knew more than I did. I mean, all young people think they know more than they did. And the left was, at that time in the 80s, just screaming stuff that was like hysterical, and it annoyed me. So I had a more conservative position, and I was very conservative for the time. My political show, one of my political phone-in show, I had a picture of Ronald Reagan on one side and Superman in front of the American flag on the other. And I thought I knew everything about the world. And of course I didn't. When I ran in 1990, I was recruited by the local Progressive Conservative Riding Association because I had interviewed their candidate in the previous election, and that candidate said I was more conservative than him. So they recruited me. Like I said, I was like 23. And make no mistake, we had no illusions that I was going to win. It was in a riding that conservatives didn't win. But I knocked on the thousands of doors and so on with my colleagues. And I became the Riding Association president and became very active on a provincial level. And then Mike Harris got elected and started putting in all these policies. Basically, they were beating up on welfare moms a lot, even though as somebody associated with the party, I saw the internal research which said that welfare moms were like under 1%. What they were depicting was like under 1%. And I went to a meeting of my riding association and I said, I am not comfortable with beating up on mothers who have to raise kids on welfare. And everybody turned on me. These people I'd been friends with for a number of years. Like, oh, comrade, have you joined the party now? And like I'm a communist. And I turned around. I ended the meeting. I left. I never went back. And from there, I just became much more aware of the realities of the world. And I don't think you can be conservative, especially not the conservatism of today. I don't think you can be a conservative, aware of the realities of the world, and continue to take the positions conservatives do without being at your core a very selfish or fearful person. And I don't like to think I'm either.
Well, a lot of older conservatives will say to people, especially young people, oh, you'll get more conservative as you get older. But oftentimes that's not the case, and case in point.
Oh, yeah. When I was younger, there used to be a statement that if you're not a socialist when you're a teen or youth, you have no heart. If you're not a conservative when you're an adult, you have no head. Well, I went the other way. So I guess I had no heart and then I have no head. Because I bucked the trend and went the other way. But, people don't become more conservative. They just become less irate or less black and white. They still care about social justice. They come to recognize that issues are a little more complex and that the easy answers they thought they had when they were, yelling at protests or whatever, those easy answers don't work. And so, their concerns for people and their concerns about issues, I don't think those change. I think their perception of the level of complication in fixing it changes.
I admit that I did have some conservative views too in high school. For example, I wanted Canada to have the same gun laws that the United States has, you know, open carry laws and stuff like that. And I was also a global warming skeptic, but I've completely changed ever since then. You know, like I have guns for hunting, but I don't feel the need to carry them around all the time like they do in the States. So
I don't have an issue with responsible hunters, you know, using, you know, I don't have a problem with, you know, proper hunting rifles and so on. I don't think you need a submachine gun or whatever they are to hunt a deer. And most people are concerned, you know, about handguns and the proliferation of those military style weapons. The thing about Canada, unlike the States, in the state, like I listen to American radio and I'll hear people who are liberals say, no, I understand people have a right to have a gun to defend themselves. And my thought is always, from whom? Why are Americans so convinced they're going to need to defend themselves from somebody? Like, why are they so suspicious of their neighbors, their fellow citizens? Why do they feel so insecure in their safety that even liberals say, no, I understand having a gun for self-defense. I've never felt that I needed a gun for self-defense in this city or in this country. I think Canadians, by and large, we don't give in to dog whistles. It's changing. Unfortunately, on the right and somewhat on the left, but we don't jump in with both feet to things. We take a little more dispassionate, rational view. And that's because we're outside the U.S., so we can be observers rather than participants, and we can learn lessons that the participants wouldn't.
I want to talk about Ed the Sox radio show. For people that haven't listened to it, what kinds of things can they expect to hear on that particular show? I imagine that sometimes it's hard for Ed the Sox not to say the seven dirty words that you can't say on the radio.
No, it's never really a problem. My feeling is that the occasional like fuck or shit is good, because sometimes those words, frick and stuff, they don't carry the impact that carries the joke or the emotion that goes with it. But that's occasional. I think anybody who relies on those seven words is not a particularly great comic, because those words are intended to basically make you laugh in a lot of cases. I remember, I don't know if you're old enough to remember a cartoon named Ren and Stimpy, but are you?
I've heard about it. Yeah, I just never watched it.
Ren and Stimpy was revolutionary in animation back in the 80s. And it was goofy and gross and so on. And the guy who created it, a guy named John Crisfalusi, he didn't own them. Nickelodeon did. And eventually Nickelodeon let him own the characters, I believe. And so he did a series of cartoons. And the cartoons he did for Nickelodeon were brilliantly funny, subversive, clever. And then when he was able to just put as much sex and swearing into the cartoons as possible, they were horrible. They were unwatchable. I always say a kite rises against the wind. So it's better to skirt the edge and everybody knows what you're thinking. And then they're in on the joke than to just swear. And what you won't hear on the radio show is discussion of politics or of any religious debate. We'll discuss religious holidays that are occurring and how people celebrate them and so on. But no, we're not having a debate of religion versus atheism. It is, I call it the nighttime neighborhood, because I didn't know this was going to be the way it was when the show started, but quickly developed. The show's on from midnight till 5 a.m., Monday to Friday. And the best of show called the All-Star All-Night Show is Saturday and Sunday. I didn't know what to expect when I started out. You know, you have this idea of who's there after midnight. I rapidly discovered that there's a huge audience of people who work overnight or who are night owls, and they felt so seen by this show being live, because there's nothing else like this anywhere nearby that's not only live but takes calls and takes live song requests. There's nothing. And they feel so included. They feel so validated. And we started getting very quickly a series of regular callers. There's probably a stable right now of about 15 regular callers mixed in with, you know, new callers all the time. And these callers all have their own personalities, and they're all very strong personalities. funny, quirky, nutso. It's a real mix, and there's a real camaraderie that exists between them. Even though I can only talk to one at a time, I started a Facebook page called Ed the Sox Nighttime Neighborhood, where they can talk to each other. But the sense of community that we have fostered on this show is like nothing I've really ever been a part of, even when I was in community television or Much Music, which was interactive for its time. It is funny. Sometimes Ed is cast in the position of almost being a straight man because these people are so out there. And it's, how do I put it? It's a slightly different Ed. People used to like the Ed from Much Music more because Ed from Much Music was slightly more intellectual than City TV, which was hot tubs and nonsense. And this is sort of an extension of that. Ed being the observer and very scientifically pointing out where people have said something really stupid or done something stupid. And the people just laugh because it's all good nature. There's no meanness involved. So it is really a community. And, as a result, there was a caller who was clearly an alcoholic, had problems with alcohol, regular caller. And he called in one time and said there'd been an intervention and they wanted him to go to rehab. And Ed encouraged him to go to rehab and we'd be behind him. And then other callers called up and encouraged him to go to rehab and talked about their rehab stories and their challenges. So he went to rehab and I told him, do you want to do an audio report every night telling us what rehab is like? And he jumped at it. And one of the problems with people going to rehab and stuff like that is they're walled off from the outside world. So it's an artificial environment. And when they go back into the real world, it's not the same cocoon that it was in rehab, so old habits connect. So these reports that he was doing kept him connected to the nighttime neighborhood, to the outside world, and kept them connected to him and him connected to them. And he's sober now 4 or 5 months. And there was I was called about a teenage kid who was threatening suicide, who was ready to commit suicide, and his parents didn't seem to care. This was his boss that was calling, and I addressed the kid by name on the radio and gave him a little bit of a pep talk and a little bit of some perspective and said, you know, you can text me or you can call. And the kid had been terribly bullied at school. Just his name being said and somebody on the radio talking to him made him feel validated, made him feel important and significant and like somebody. And he went to school the next day and he hasn't threatened suicide since. And there's all kinds of stories like that. Friendships that are broken apart that Ed has put back together. And people call sometimes, they just have some things, they just personal things they want to ask, which always I'm like, geez. Sometimes it's Ed that they talk to. Sometimes the appropriate thing is not Ed. But it's, I feel so connected with these people. When I go to work doing this show, I feel like I'm going to hang out with friends. And when I go to work for this show, I actually just go to the basement of my house because the station put in equipment so I can do the show live from my house. Because they're in Oshawa and I'm outside Newmarket. And every night was an hour and 10 minute drive each way, which I know commutes in Toronto far longer. But on the drive out there, I would get like relaxed, right? And you can't be relaxed and be Ed. You can't be too mellow. And then driving home at 5 o'clock, I just wanted to be home. The last little leg was very tiresome. I had to constantly drink energy drinks. So, and also the cost of gas was insane. This is before it went to summer gas costs. So they put in a thing so I can do it from home, which is a lot, you know, it's a lot better for me, a lot more comfortable.
Well, Ed the Sock has done a lot of really good things, you know, helping people in need and making people laugh. Although occasionally there have been some controversies with Ed the Sock over some things that he may have said. How do you respond to those kinds of controversies? And what do you say to people that might not have anything nice to say about what they were offended by in the first place?
Well, it all depends. Do I see the point in what they're saying? Was it something that was badly worded? Or maybe was done quickly and not given enough thought? So I don't automatically reject it. But if I see it and it's just, well, you don't like that I have this perspective. On Twitter, well, Twitter X now, I barely ever, as Ed, respond to people who reply to Ed's tweets. I put them out there and I let them live. I don't even look at the interactions because I'm not interested in fights with people. Because they're rarely ever, there used to be dialogues on Twitter. Now it's not. Now it's just one side or the other lining up to scream. And I'm not interested in that.
Well, I think that you or Ed the Sock would do a really good job running a TV station. A couple of years ago, you tried to start a streaming platform called New Music Nation, which showcased music videos from independent artists. Was that idea based on Much Music?
In a way. When I was at Much Music, I used to always say we should be playing videos from artists people haven't heard of. And their answer was, no, they have to be people signed by the record label, because if we play people who aren't, if that isn't our point of entry, if we lower the point of entry, how do you play some people's videos and not other people's videos? And my answer was, by playing some people's videos and not other people's videos. We do it now with the record companies. Not all videos that are submitted get played. It's based on quality. And they just wouldn't do it. And I felt a platform like Much Music could have been used to help a lot of really talented artists. And so I wanted to do something like that. And the problem with New Music Nation, and it's not completely dead. We're trying to figure out how to make it work, but the model didn't work. What went wrong with that is the idea was Ed and other VJs who I had recruited and trained, we were going to shoot outside, like Much Music, you know, VJ style things, interacting with people. And in the winter, the plan was go inside malls and talk to people and go to people's homes, have them invite us over and do stuff, you know, do goofy things in their homes. And then COVID hit and all of that was out the window. We couldn't do any of that. And so we weren't able to, and I didn't want to compromise the quality by just doing VJ throws sitting in front of Zoom. Like, to me, that didn't have, there was one show that it made sense for. That we did, Nerd Music Nation, that made sense for it. But the others, it didn't. And I didn't want to compromise what it was supposed to look like. Also, the thought was we do a crowdfund to get some initial funds to pay me to make it a full-time job to get this stuff going. Because we had like 2,000 videos submitted. And most of them were really good, I will say. So you have to screen them. There's a lot of work that goes into that in production and editing. So the idea is get started with a crowdfund, and then the crowdfund launches the product. You can then use the product to sell it to advertisers. Well, I didn't know how difficult selling online stuff to advertisers was. And especially at that time, people were looking, companies were saying, well, if you don't have 1 million views, nowadays they know 1 million views, people just buy views. So they're not, you can't trust them. But it was, you couldn't, selling was very difficult. I am not a sales, I can sell somebody, but I can't do the cold call. I can't do the initial connection. And it was COVID. Nobody was advertising. So eventually the money ran out and it lost steam. So now we're trying to figure out how we can do it in a way that isn't work intensive, that makes it a full-time job and isn't reliant on looking for advertiser money. The idea was I did a thing, VJ for a day in the fundraiser. I wanted people contributed money to the fundraiser to become a VJ for a day. Well, like none of them followed up on it. I chased them for it. I kept sending out things and sending out information forms about here's how you do it. Contact me if you have questions. Like 6 people bothered out of over 100. The idea was that they were going to do some of the heavy lifting with shooting the stuff themselves. That took a huge burden off of me. They didn't do it. We've got one new show launching called Totally Random Hip Hop Show, put together by a guy out in Saskatchewan. It's all, the first episode is all Indigenous hip hop. His name is Cross LePage. He's a DJ and performer. And he just contacted me, said he wanted to do it. So he put the whole thing together himself. And he sent it to me, and then I re-edited it to give it some polish. And that's going to go out mid-June. But, you know, so I still am really committed to wanting to show those videos. And I try to run songs on the All Night Show by bands people haven't heard of to give them some chance. But it's, you know, it was a disappointment to me that if COVID hadn't happened, God knows where we would be now with that. But COVID nailed a lot of different initiatives, not just mine.
Well, I think it's really good that you and Ed the Sock wanted to help give publicity to up-and-coming artists, which is something that I've done a lot of over the years, interviewing guests here on the Medley and playing music on a volunteer radio show that I hosted by independent artists. So I think it's really cool that you're doing that. If people have their own music video, say an independent band made an independent video, could they submit it to New Music Nation and possibly have it up on the website?
You know, I think the website is still there. So, yeah, I haven't pushed it, so we haven't had submissions in a while, but I can go and check the submissions. And, yeah, if we get more submissions, I'll try to do something. I'm not sure if the well, I'll ask you. We did long-form shows, like an hour with a bunch of videos. I'm not sure if that's something people want anymore. I'm not sure if it shouldn't be just one video at a time. What do you think?
Gee, that's a good question.
Okay, well, anybody listening, if they have an idea, they can email me at edthesock@therock.fm, T-H-E-R-O-C-K, edthesock@therock.fm, and let me know what they think. And by the way, you can find Ed on Twitter, at edthesock, Instagram, ed_the_sock. Same thing on TikTok, but I've sort of stepped away from TikTok because it's it melts my brain. It is so stupid there. And there's a Facebook, you know, Ed has a Facebook page as well. I think it's called Ed the Sock Official. I should know, but I don't. Where, you know, I'm somewhat active. I'm right now just trying to decide if that Facebook page is going to be more for my radio show, which doesn't talk about politics and things, or more for the political stuff. So I'm not sure. I don't think it's something that can be both right now, because tempers are so high. I don't think it can be both. I'm trying to figure that out. Like I said, I'm on 94.9 The Rock. It comes out of Oshawa, broadcast to the GTA, Monday to Friday, midnight to 5 a.m. Eastern time. And you can also, and the weekend shows, same time. And you can also go to therock.fm or The Rock app to listen to its streaming. And also there's the on-demand section there. There's some of my weekend shows, my best of shows with just the calls. They're there. I have been terribly lazy about posting them. I produce them, but then I don't post them. I don't know why, because it's a little extra work.
Steve and Ed, it was great to have you on the show this week. And thank you so very much for your time. And I will keep following you on social media. And I look forward to seeing what happens in the future.
Okay, great. By the way, check out The Rock's Instagram as well as Ed's Instagram. I put up video. Ed's doing interviews with bands now. And the videos go up, like, they're 1.5 minute clips of popular bands. So I just did one with Bare Naked Ladies, Motley Crue. So check that out. You can find it on Ed's Instagram or The Rock's Instagram.
And that was Steven Kersner, the creator and performer of Ed the Sock. I hope that you enjoyed this edition of The Medley. And remember, here at The Medley, we're all kinds of different.